Welcome and thank you for listening to this discussion, which is coming to you from Trades Hall in Melbourne, Australia. Our topic today is syndicalism in Australia and Sweden, the IWW and the SAC. And I work on the Reason and Revolt source documents in Australian Radicalism website. And I'll be speaking with Gabriel Kuhn and Dave Karen. Syndicalism is a type of economic system proposed as a replacement for capitalism and state socialism, which uses federations of collectivised trade unions. Today, Gabriel and Dave will tell us about their experiences and thoughts regarding two syndicalist unions. The first is the IWW, which stands for the Industrial Workers of the World, or the Wobblies, an international union based in America. The second syndicalist union is the SAC, S-A-C, which in Sweden, in Swedish, stands for the Central Organisation of the Workers of Sweden. Gabriel Kuhn is a member of both the IWW and the S-A-C. He's currently visiting Australia. Dave Karen is a member of the IWW in Australia and is an organiser with the Mining Division of the Construction, Forestry, Mining and Energy Union in Morwell in Victoria. Tell us about the IWW.
Yeah, well, the Wobblies set up in 1904 in America and 1907 here. And the same year, coincidentally, the Harvester Judgment was handed down, which went further along the road of arbitration and conciliation and put in place a social contract. Yeah. And both the Wobblies and the social contract come out of the decades of struggle from the 1850s through to the Depression in the 1890s. The workers' movement here was gaining in strength, and even though it had experienced some significant defeats in the 1890s, it had learned a lot from that. And so the conclusions people were drawing was that the one big union was something that we needed. The anti-war movement, of course, came along in 1914, and the Wobblies here played a major role in that, in the anti-conscription campaigns and the referendum, the two referenda that were held about conscription, and played a mighty role. And as a result of their activities, many of them did some pretty heavy jail time out here. They continued on under other names and as dual unionists inside other unions for decades after, up into the 1930s, the Wobblies in New South Wales were on a par with the Communist Party in terms of numbers, although at the time you'd have to look up Verity's book actually to find out the name of it. I can't remember now. But so as a younger man in the 70s coming into contact with their thinking, I was active with the BLF and in the Green Bands, and here was a form of social union, social movement unionism that, you know, predated the BLF, and so it caught my imagination as a young bloke. Mm. And then I went through the deregistration of the BLF in the 80s, where the union movement, because of various leaderships and factional strife, turned on each other and to the detriment of everyone involved, and the boss was the only winner. So that highlighted again to me that. And then when Howard got in and brought in the worst of the sort of anti-worker laws and sort of fascist legislation, a few of us realised that the union movement wasn't set up to cope with what was coming. And we, at the end of 2004, we established Union Solidarity, which was based on the Wobblies' notion of one big union, an injury to one is an injury to all. Effectively, without calling it the IWW, we established it. The other lesson in that for me was there were no membership lists, no minutes of meetings held, no assets, nothing that an organisation could come dependent upon, and therefore nothing that the employers could grab through courts and fines and that sort of stuff. So we were just there to struggle and grow and learn through the struggle, and we didn't have very many losses. Well, in fact, I sort of always consider we didn't actually have any losses. Some of them are still ongoing, but in one year we did more than 30 picket lines. So it was pretty full on for 4 years, and everybody just did themselves a real treat, and whether they know it or not, they behave like Wobblies.
That's great.
How was international solidarity at the time? I'd just be curious.
Well, just predating Union Solidarity in 1998, a lot of the lessons that were learnt that drove people into union solidarity were learnt out of the MUA dispute in 1998, and that received a lot of international support because the MUA is one union that is part of a strong international and, you know, behaves like it, like got good internationalist principles. So, yeah, that was one instance. And certainly we were always ready to reach out and ask for help and offer it where we could. So we were active as we could be in defending the rights of workers in other countries and participated in giving all sorts of assistance, some which I could talk about, some I can't. But we certainly gave a lot of, as much as we could, a lot of help insofar as just bringing people in to meet with the existing union movements and get those meetings set up where we could help people from other countries network and receive the sort of support they had. Because when the Communist Party closed its doors here, a lot of that work went by the by. I mean, the Labor Party doesn't do that work. It the extent to which it, you know, it provides a political leadership for the organised labour movement, it's just along the lines of, well, you get out and help Labor get elected and then leave the rest to us. So we tried to, in the small ways that we could, reintroduce that internationalism back in. I mean, that activist internationalism.
That's good. Can we just go back a step and can you tell us about what the IWW stands for in terms of its values, its aims and tactics, I suppose? What makes it different from the normal trade union movements that we hear about on the media and we see all the time, if you know what I mean? Well, the philosophy, I suppose.
Yeah, the Wobblies were on about and remain on about changing the society that we live in and not just simply arguing for a bigger share of the existing one.
Mm-hmm.
We believe that the extent to which unions have been successful in winning a share of the existing society has only been for a small minority of workers in the world. And to an extent, we did it at the expense of our fellow workers elsewhere. So I guess it's trying to bring people together on the basis that that sort of society, first a division of the world into first, second and third world, was only a temporary phenomenon anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It was, by its own dynamic, it was always going to come to an end. And we can see with globalisation the same laws being moved all around the world, driving people down into the third world conditions inside first world countries, you can see that process happening. So more and more, there were, especially with Howard and that really strong neoliberal agenda, you saw a bunch of workers looking around and seeing that our current union movement, as we were based, which was based on a set of laws that had us and the employer as litigants before the law, but that style of unionism was now not capable of doing what it even used to do, let alone for those of us who are concerned about a more just set of arrangements in the world. Was never designed for that anyway. And I guess it's taken the decades across the 20th century for that to be firmly established. So I think that the first thing about the Wobblies is that they were there to provide the sort of organisational structure that one day could see workers run the industries that they currently worked in. Because after all, if you look at the industries where they were based, you know, in the building industry, in the shearing sheds, and some on the waterfront, workers run rail. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The extent to which there's a bureaucracy involved when it was public sector. And a lot of those public sector supervisory managerial layers in the old public sector went over into the private sector anyway. So they were skilled in the public sector. For all those decades, workers ran rail. I mean, the living proof was the public sector inside capitalist societies that, yes, workers can run the economy. And the next thing was the Wobblies were keen to make sure that the economy was a democratic space.
Yes.
So, Union Solidarity, we ran that line for the entire 4 years of our activism, that we were not asking for anything more than the employing class has, only what they have, which is we wanted to be equal with them. We wanted an equal say within the economy as part of a democratic space, and then we believe that the vast majority in a democratic space will will skew the economy and the society we live in a more democratic, thoroughly democratic direction.
Just to add a couple of points, maybe, I think ideologically, and that would be the same for a lot of syndicalist organizations or for syndicalism in general, is also that you're not trying to reform the wage labor system, you're trying to abolish the wage labor system. I mean, I think that's one of the kind of basic fundamentals. Then also in terms of action, I mean, the principle of direct action, that you're not trying to enter negotiations through mediators, but that you, so to speak, take those negotiations into your own hands, or refuse to negotiate if it seems that that doesn't lead anywhere, and take other action. I think that's another important thing. And then what's already been mentioned, I think the notion of the one big union, if you compare it to mainstream trade unions, I think in most countries, I mean, one aspect, definitely that internationalist aspect. Another aspect, which I think has been traditionally really important for the IWW, and I think is very important also today, and might be one of the reasons why there's a resurgence of IWW groups in various countries, is that under that notion of the one big union, it's actually possible to organize workers who often don't find a place in mainstream trade unions, migrant workers, temporary workers, etc., which so-called now often under that label of precarious work. I think that's a big issue today. A lot of trade unions, mainstream trade unions, I don't think have an answer to that, and I think that the syndicalist model offers better prospects there. And there was another aspect that I thought of, but I forgot.
I was going to mention about the thing about direct democracy within the union itself. It's a union works show. It works from the ground up in terms of is that the way you see it too,
yeah,
Dave? The
too
important
right,
part of it.
Too right, and I've been in unions where the New South Wales BLF, for instance, or the miners union at the moment, where there are very few full timers. It's every resolution has to go out to the rank and file.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, just got knocked back on a really wonderful project at the moment.
So we've got to
keep working away until we win it. We got knocked off, if you like, for all of the right reasons.
Yes.
That is, the members were firmly in control. So, but on the other hand, like as Gabe said, I'm currently working as an organiser in a union where the employer can say that I can either come in or not come into a workplace.
Mm.
And that my members are not the determinant factor in that.
Mm.
But it's him. And, I'm currently an organiser in a union where he can hold whatever meetings he wants without asking anyone's permission. But my members have to ask permission. I'm currently an organiser where our members create, you know, billions of dollars a year for this mob, and the money goes directly to a minority of shareholders who own the company. So, you know, all the things that existed in 1907 in Australia when the Wobbly set up, all of the same divisions and dynamic is there, except that now we're looking at a capitalism in decline and not in the ascendancy. And I think that's, to follow on from Gabe's point before, we have to be up on our toes dancing now, because, and talking about the syndicalist tradition in a new way, I mean, as an economic democracy, and asking of people, why would employers be, or any government, be scared of the notion of an economy that was democratically controlled and collectively owned? I mean, why would people be concerned about that? And that's the debate. We've got to get that back on the agenda, but it's got to be in very practical terms. So I think one of the aspects of syndicalism too was that idea of building the new world within the shell of the old.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think the Wobbly's got a chance in the earlier years to investigate that thoroughly. But certainly some of us have been now working away for some time, and looks like it's starting to come to fruition, where we begin to set up and establish a social sector of the Australian economy. That is, where workers are working in their own collectively owned enterprises, and a sector of the economy that we're not just saying to people, well, we're talking about some golden age off in the future. We're actually talking about the here and now.
Well, come back to that. Gabe, can you respond to what Dave's been saying?
A lot of what Dave said reminded me of the third point I wanted to make before.
Yes.
In terms of syndicalist organizing generally. speaking both of rank and file organization and then also overcoming divisions, one key factor, of course, of the IWW has also been not to organize along trade lines, but to have one big unit and bring workers, regardless of what exactly it is that they do together, so that they can fight for their common interests. Because traditionally, arguably, a lot of trade unions have been used in a very classical sense of divide and conquer by the bosses, so people look out for the interests that a relatively small group or a faction of the working class actually stands for, and then that's going to be played out against the interests of another faction, which overall weakens all factions, because I think it's fairly obvious that, the stronger the unity between the workers is, the more effective the struggle can be.
The union solidarity was, as I say, based entirely on the principle that Gabe's just outlined, and we showed that it worked. So from my perspective, from a Wobblies perspective, I think one of the ways we can actually practically offer the workers' movement in this country a way forward is by establishing that principle over time, where if there's a blue on, then everybody's in. And at least if we can create the one big union in terms of the way we fight, and then along that path, there's all the discussion with our friends and our comrades and about, well, what is it we're fighting for? A more highly paid service sector, because like we're 80% service sector in the economy. Capitalism is saying all I'm capable of giving Australians is a social sector and resource extraction, pretty much, now, and the ancillary jobs that grow off that. But that's not a future. That's not the complex sort of economy we need to be establishing now, with a renewable power grid and organics and we need the people engaged. So what are we fighting for? Well, we've got to be a part of what we're fighting for is an organisation that's capable of making the decisions democratically. So the means and the ends are very, very much,
I think what's important in what they've been saying is also that the notion of one big union is just an important guiding principle for workers' struggle generally, because sometimes you come across people who think that, the IWW is too weak in numbers to even claim, such principles, like what's, the one big union or whatever, but to me that kind of misses the point. It's more of a principle that guides workers' struggle.
Yeah. Dave's been given, drawing some really good pictures about sort of the history of the IWW and its role in Australian unionism and stuff like that, and a few good, great examples and stories. Can you sort of give us a bit of a rundown on those sorts of things with regard to the SAC?
Not at all to the same extent,
okay.
For the very simple reason that I moved to Sweden only a few years ago.
Okay.
And became a member of the SSE. I've been an IWW member longer. So.
Okay. Yeah.
Apart from that, I haven't been involved at all in worker struggle to the same extent that Dave has been. So
all I can do
in terms of, with reference to the SAC, is tell a little about the history that I know.
Yeah.
In that sense, I think one of the most interesting aspects of the SAC's history is, a general debate between reformism and a more revolutionary outlook that I think is part of the syndicalist history as well. There's been different waves in the SAC. There's so-called, like as I said, reformist periods, and then there were periods where more kind of, anarchists, self-declared anarchists were strong in the union. That's, I think, generally an interesting aspect also in terms, again, history of the IWW. The political ideology that comes with it, or that does not come with it, because even though a lot of anarchist principles, if you will, have always been part of the IWW and the syndicalism, a lot of syndicalists, it's very important for them to not associate themselves with a certain political ideology, even if it is
because it's non-sectarian.
One of the reasons why some people find that dangerous, if you will. So, I even know people who personally would, call themselves anarchists and aren't syndicalist organizations, but they would not want the organization to be called anarchist, because I think they have that fear that it would, people would shy away from it just because of that label.
I agree, and I think again, if we had gone too far down the road of describing to people what the roots of union solidarity was.
Yes.
We'd have been lost in a historical debate that knows no bottom, has no end to it. And I guess one of the things I've learned now over time is if we truly are part of that historical tradition tendency, then we have to be able to let go of the constraints of any one set of definitions or conceptualizations, mm-hmm. and to be able to speak in many languages. And to that extent, I mean, I think, you know, it's about, like, if I look at the left, because certainly historically the IWW is a left-wing union, that's what it's about. But if I look at the left, it's like a dysfunctional family that split up many years ago. And it's time that we got back together because Christmas is coming, you know? Mm. So we sort of, we need to accept, I think, like the lessons that we've all learned over the, I mean, I had close to 40 years of the 20th century where I've been an active leftist, or 30 years in the 20th century.
Yes.
10 years now. And, you know, what I've learned is that there are so many good comrades in all of the left organisations, that they're their comrades and their friends and all. And we've worked together on so many things, and that's what's important, and that's what it is to be, for me anyway, like a leftist. And I don't need for them to speak a particular way or think in a particular, with a particular mindset, or hang out with a particular group. If they can cop me, well, I can cop them. And the important thing is, what are we offering to our fellow workers who are not of the left? What are we? Because they're saying to the left after the 20th century, working people are saying to us, you show us, don't tell us. You reckon you're so good and you've got something to offer. Well, you didn't do too well in the 20th century, so, you know, what sort of runs are you going to get on the board this time? So I think it is about that. And we know from our practice in the 20th century, that's not about teaching people to get the right conceptual framework right, or say it in the right way, or, you know, make sure you're selling only the one newspaper. Like, if they'd have me, I'd join every left group, all of them.
And can I just say, Gabriel, can we just talk about globalisation for a sec? Edward Herman describes globalisation. He says what the people like the WTO refer to as globalisation is a set of neoliberal economic policies, such as privatisation. Is what the IWW has been doing since the start of the century, last century, and with Union Solidarity and these sorts of programs, is that, can you describe that as a mobilisation, if you like, against these kind of neoliberal policies?
What do you mean? Was it back then? Because they were neoliberal policies back then. Of course, they
I suppose you'd be more international capitalism. You'd refer to it back then, but maybe. What do you think about
that? I think generally just what we said before, that internationalist aspect, I think, has always been really strong. And I think, you know, within the times of what, you know, is now called neoliberalism or neoliberal globalization, it just takes on new forms. And it, in a sense, you might even say that historically it kind of proves that approach, right? Because I think that's one of the main problems today, too, if you look at the rhetoric of a lot of mainstream trade unions, like their critical responses, if you will, to neoliberalism or neoliberal globalization, I think very often is coded in rather protectionist, or you might even say nationalist terms, which I think creates big problems politically. And again, I think in the long run, even or certainly weakens a united workers' struggle, because what in the short run might look like an advantage for the relative privilege that certain workers have in a certain country over those in others will in the long run weaken their status in relation to the bosses or capitalists too. So I think my short answer basically to that question would be, neoliberal globalization just sheds new light on the importance of the internationalist outlook of syndicalism to begin with.
Yeah, I agree, and I think you know, Australia was relatively unique. If you look back at the start of last century when the WOBS set up, and remember, certainly didn't just arrive from America and set up in 1907. There were decades of struggle that led to the people reaching those conclusions in 1907. But you were looking at an Australia where there were two major parties. One was a protectionist party and one was the Free Trade Party. And they were so freaked out by the development of the workers' organisation and how powerful it was, they united into one party. Mm. Now, you know, that's a fairly... That's telling you something. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
And can you tell us the dates of when this happened?
Oh, no, I'm not an academic.
I'm suspecting it's sort of the end of the 19th century.
I live with this history rather than know its dates. But
no, that's okay.
But the fact that, you know, people like us weren't so relevant once that social contract was in place. Mm. You know, it's like if there was a way back to the pre-Howard or the pre-Keating sort of unionism, the pre-enterprise bargaining agreement type of, the pre-accord unionism, if there was a way back to it, then again, people like us would be no longer relevant because you'd be looking at a unionism that says, all right, you're part of roughly 12 to 20% of a privileged group, more privileged group of workers than workers elsewhere. We don't torture you, we don't jar you, we don't shoot you because you don't eat much. You know what I mean? We need you out there to consume. Yeah. So if there was a way back in, well then of course you need unions that have their lawyers, they have organisers who know how to live within an arbitration and conciliation system, that know all of the ways in which they strive to be equal litigants with the employer before the bench. And I guess our message back at the turn of last century has now come full circle, that's not possible anymore. And capitalism simply can't provide that sort of social contract. I mean, they're not lying to us when they tell us they can't afford manufacturing jobs in a country like Australia. Mm-hmm. They're telling us the truth. There's not enough growth left within capitalism for them to be able to build a big enough surplus or profit to be able to afford those jobs here. They've got to go to the depressed labour economies, you know, to the so-called undeveloped capitalist society. So, you know, where does that leave us? Where does that leave our current union movement? And I think that requires great patience. It requires us to, even though we figure we've got those sort of answers and we've learnt those from life, not to be arrogant about it, because a lot of workers are really loyal to their union, and that's a good thing. So it's a matter of, all right, what are the ways we can contribute here in this culture? Because it's a relatively unique multicultural culture. What are the ways we can contribute along the lines that the Wobblies lessons would teach us? Because we have gone back to that fork in the road, social contract or the free enterprise system, where capitalism actually gets back to its main game. And that's, I think, where we are. So the Wobblies now come back on stream, and let's go down that road together. I remember debating this bloke. He does their international stuff for the Institute for Public Affairs. What's his name? He's a young
Roscoe?
Young bloke. He's in the media all the time.
Fully Love?
I'll think of his name in a minute. Wilson? Or no. He said he came on TV and we debated, yeah? And I said to him, because when union solidarity was at its height. And I said to him, we're not against a free market. Yeah? He said, oh, everybody says that, but they add a but. And I said, well, no, I'm not adding a but, I'm adding an and. And he said, an and? I said, yes, and the working class. You can't call it a free market if the working class isn't equally free within it. And you support laws that mean we're not free within that marketplace, because you know without those laws we become the majority. If it's a democratic space, we become the majority, and we'll change that economy just by being the fact we've got a different set of collective vested interests. Mm-hmm. And he said, in the end, he said, I don't support those laws, which is interesting in itself. But I said, oh, well, can I get that in writing? So, but you know what I mean? It's like, there they are, the free marketeers. At the end of the day, they're in a real bind. They've got to go to the free market to get the last remaining bit of growth out of capitalism. But by doing it, they free us up to organise differently in a new way that can actually challenge capitalism.
Which is interesting, just to connect to that. I think it, you know, what Dave's been saying about the fact that it's no coincidence that whatever, you know, multinational companies move their production sites to different countries, or that it's not, you know, sustainable for them to have them, for example, in Australia or in the industrialized, other industrialized nations. I think from a revolutionary or anti-capitalist perspective, that of course opens the interesting question, what happens if you could make a contribution to the fact that no countries, even the, you know, the now so-called third world countries, would be attractive sites for these companies to produce? Like, where, you know, where would they go? And I think that, to me, again, stresses the importance of international union connections, and if you're like global worker struggle, it's a big word, but I think that, you know, could take us enormous ways. And I mean, for one, of course, then also the whole environmental question comes into play, which I understand Dave's also been active in, because it's not only the fact that the wages are lower and workers, you know, have less union protections often in countries outside of the industrialized world, but there's also there are also still different environmental requirements that have to be met. So I think all these factors contribute to the shifting of production sites and outsourcing and whatnot. So if we'd be able to build a strong international resistance to that, that takes both into account, like, you know, situations at the workplace and environmental questions, I think that's kind of like a key factor for any radical movement.
Yeah.
For the years to come.
I agree, and just building on what Gabe was saying, that idea of a newly internationalising workers' movement that's you know, that doesn't stop where the factory gate or the office door ends. It's out into the community, so that the community can respond. You know, we can respond as a working class community, rather than as separate groups of workers to situations that are happening inside our borders, but globally as well. So I think by having a combined movement that has all of the social weight that can establish and defend rights, but alongside that, to be looking at the labour movement to labour movement trade agreements, where we actually build social sector trade agreements, so that at the same point we are not just standing outside someone's factory saying, we don't like the fact that you are not doing this. We're actually building factories that are doing such and such. And so, and that's a different ballgame. When we actually do what capitalism did under feudalism, when we actually start to establish a part of the economy that workers own and control, at the same time as we're fighting inside the other sectors of the capitalist economy, then we are not just protesters, because that, to me, has been, out of my 40 years in, one of the failings, I believe, that I've participated in, was that at the end of the day, we developed, at our best, very powerful protest movements, but we never went beyond protest into change. And I think that's... So it's getting that right now, I think, for us old-timers who can lay some of the foundations alongside younger fellow workers and get out of their way, because I think that's going to take off like a rocket. And especially if you base it around wealth-creating manufacturing jobs into the renewables. That's, I think, and to do that globally.
Now, you're involved in an example of that with the CFMEU project.
Mining and energy branch in Morwell. We're looking at the Earthworker project, which puts in place worker-owned control factories that manufacture the range of green technologies, solar hot water units, wind generators, biomass, etc. We want to put those factories in Morwell because it's a transition out of brown coal.
This is the miners' union which is doing this, which is an interesting thing, because they're all coal miners, aren't they, in Morwell?
Absolutely, and massive difference and debate over it all, as you'd expect. We want to try and stamp that out in every state of Australia, but we also have initiated discussions with the Venezuelans about doing the same factory there, and then throughout Latin, Central and South America, and then work with the labour movements in other countries, so that just slowly and deliberately we establish this social sector. Mm-hmm. Now, you put that together with an organisation that can also fight and win industrially, then you know, then you're cooking with someone.
To emphasize the importance, I think, of everything that Dave's just said, I also think that often within the radical left, even there's a kind of false dichotomy of, you know, creating cooperatives on the one hand and, you know, being engaged in the wider class struggle on the other hand. Like, sometimes that's seen as a contradiction because you're saying, well, you know, you build your cooperative and you don't care about, you know, anyone else, basically, or, you know, the situation of other workers. You have your own little kind of, you know, egalitarian self-managed niche. Or you do engage in class struggle, and then, you know, you have the criticism that you're not actively engaged in actually building alternative economic structures. I think both criticisms are valid to a certain point, but the fact is that it's not necessarily a contradiction, because obviously you can do both at the same time, and I think that's indeed terribly important, because if you only focus on building your cooperative, but you're surrounded by a wage labor system, eventually, it will be very hard, basically, to maintain your cooperative, or, you know, spread, have other cooperatives appear so that it become big enough to have a network that actually, you know, starts building a viable alternative for a lot of people. On the other hand, if you, you know, let's say exclusively engage in fighting the wage labor system without building alternative economies, it'll be a constant struggle, which I think in many ways is good, but eventually also very exhausting, and then a lot of people kind of, you know, retreat or burn out. Like, I think you see that phenomenon very often. So I think if you can combine those two aspects, and exactly, I mean, Dave's named fabulous examples for that, I think that's really the way to go, basically.
It's also recognizing, you know, this thing about, I suppose, about the climate emergency that people are referring to now, which I think is a very, very real and, you know, the most dangerous thing we as a species have faced. But the harsh fact is that's an economic and a class question. Mm. And if we behave as though it's not, then I don't believe we can win it. It may be off in the future before workers take the economy into their own hands, but I'm convinced that if they don't, we won't survive the climate emergency. Mm-hmm. Now, that makes it all the more crucial that we get practical examples, models, up and running of workers running industry, and network those as rapidly and quickly as we can, use the resources of the union movement to assist with that. And because otherwise, you know, we are not going to protest our way out of this. It is not doable. On the other hand, capitalism is not going to economically organise our way out of this, because, of course, it's causing the problem. So the governments, in turn, neoliberal governments, are locked into those corporates for their investment. So it leaves only one other social force in this society, and that's us. Mm-hmm. So we better, you know, it's either get good at putting your feet on the ground, or get good at yoga so you can bend over and kiss your ass goodbye. You know?
But one, maybe just to throw that in real quick, I think, because we've already been talking a lot about the IWW, I mean, to its credit, it had, in the States especially, members and activists who I think addressed that question very early, like in the 1980s, Judy Barry is a really big and famous name, who were working to overcome these, again, these kind of false contradictions that were often created between, on the one hand, protecting the environment, for example, redwood forests in the States, and on the other hand, harming workers, loggers, you know, who'd lose their jobs. I mean, I see that, you know, that is a problem, but obviously in a common struggle, those can be overcome. Like, you know, there is, you can't save the redwoods and have people who are trained as loggers do work and find jobs for them. It's a matter of developing, common policies that take all these actions into, or all these aspects into account. So it's not that, you know, you're playing out the environment against the interests of workers. That's just, you're just not creative enough if you can't come up with solutions to that.
Yeah, we could talk for a lot longer about this great topic that we've been talking about, which is the role of the syndicalism in today's economy and today's politics and going way back to the start of the 19th century. How would you sum up the role of this kind of unionism, IWWism, Dave?
Oh, well, for me, I guess it's finding that new voice in the 21st century where it's accepting that we're operating within a wide range of communities, unions just being one of those, and that as we move and operate with each other as comrades and with other left comrades, that we've there are so many lessons from across the 20th century that we can pull into this, the 21st century, and I suppose to try to provide the guarantees that the same mistakes aren't made. So I think that means openness and inclusivity. It means not placing constraints around belonging outside of racism and violence and overt sexism. Then it doesn't matter whether someone's a Catholic, a Buddhist, a Hindu, a Christian, a Jew. I guess with our tradition, that's one of the things we can activate or bring into this 21st century. We can bridge across the whole historic left. Now, we've got some baggage to unpack before we do it, because we got into it as much as the rest of the left. And I think Union Solidarity showed when we're really going for it, and there were quite a few wobblies involved in Union Solidarity, that's when you see us at our best. We don't care what baggage other people have got in their case, as long as we're not carrying any. So time to put that down, get back to our basics and our roots, re-establish that. We don't even need to call it anything. We just need to do it.
I suppose just one thing, can we quickly cover something that we haven't covered, which is the tradition in the Wobblies about being non-political in terms of not getting involved in elections, voting for one party over another. Could you just talk a little bit about that was in Australia?
It was always a thing, and it goes on today, that syndicalists debate about. And my view is, you let 100 flowers bloom. There might be times where it makes perfect sense to intervene in an election. It could be a local government, it could be a regional election, it could be a state election or a national election. And I don't blame people for getting involved in the Your Rights at Work stuff. Many people involved in Union Solidarity were heavily involved in the Your Rights at Work campaign to get rid of Howard. You'd like to think that we'd know enough from the 20th century to know that what was on offer from the other side was not going to resolve the central crises that we and other nations face. And so I guess it's a matter of how do we best maintain the openness and inclusivity so that the talking can always occur, that we never turn on each other, that we're always creating a space that's solidaric in that in a truly meaningful way. And whether someone is politically of the left and they're an ML or they're a Trotskyist, or to me, it's like walking in the garden. I mean, there's just different variations, and we've got to make sure everyone receives the water and the nutrients, because none of us have got all the answers, and that's one of the other lessons, it seems to me, that we either learned or we didn't at our peril of the 20th century. The collective is the important thing, and not any of us presuming that that any of us truly know. Knowing is something we learn by doing. It's a matter of doing that with as many people who feel like brothers and sisters with us because of the way we behave towards them as possible.
Just to sum this up, I think that the non-political aspect, as you called it, of the syndicalist tradition does not imply that you're not allowed to engage in political work if you think that, that's suitable. It's just that the organization, if you will, may not be compromised in, what they provide for direct workers' struggle by political interests. So whatever people who unite in the organization to engage in workers' struggles, whatever political fight they may engage in outside of it, it's entirely up to them. And I think it's only good. To me,
I think it'd be hard to meet a syndicalist who would say that you're not allowed to do anything outside of the organization. And to me, that'd be kind of like a scary picture of syndicalism, to be perfectly honest. So this non-political aspect is not reducing people's possibilities on that level. I think it enhances people's possibilities because they are not reduced ideologically, you know, to a certain party line or whatever.
When it started, if you look in America, the Wobblies were worried that, you know, if people were too overly identified with Debs and that tradition, political tradition, then it might mean that it was, as I said before, it was saying to workers, unless you agree with that, you can't belong to the Wobblies. So they were trying to actually, it was the opposite of what it eventually, I think, became. You know, because you can turn anything into a hardened dogma, even the most libertarian of views.
That's right.
So, but here, likewise, the burgeoning Labor parties in the colonies that then became, under Federation, eventually the Labor Party, or the Communist Party, or whatever, the Wobblies here were keen to say, look, you know, it's fine for people to belong to whatever. That's the point. Mm. It's not the point that you can't, but don't make belonging a condition of being active here. If you're a working class person, then the idea was that was meant to be a hothouse for the discussion for all to be able to engage in, not the captive of one view. And that, you know what I mean?
Yes.
And when you look at us in that historical light, that's really speaking of a different future.
Okay, well, thanks people out there in internet land for listening to this little talk we've had with Dave Karen and Gabriel Kuhn on syndicalism in Australia and Sweden, the IWW and the SAC. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jack.
Thank you.